So, we come to the conclusion of this 12th chapter, The Origin of the Ignorance. We have been looking at his description philosophically of a single reality, Brahman, who is one, both reserving itself in a profound passivity, in which there is no movement within an absolute being, and then giving itself fully in a movement outwards, which is reflective of its great massed power. But both are poises of this single Brahman, and both the passivity and the expression are signatures of its concentrated conscious power, which we call tapas. So the giving into the universe and the reserving in the status of the immobile self are not an antinomy. They are the same reality. He continues with his argument with this sentence. The reality, then, is neither an eternal passivity of immobile being, nor an eternal activity of being in movement, nor is it an alternation in time between these two things. Neither, in fact, is the sole absolute truth of Brahman's reality. Their opposition is only true of it in relation to the activities of its consciousness. When we perceive its deployment of the conscious energy of its being in the universal action, we speak of it as the mobile, active Brahman. When we perceive its simultaneous reservation of the conscious energy of its being kept back from the action, we speak of it as the immobile, passive Brahman, saguna and nirguna, kshara and akshara. Otherwise, the terms would have no meaning, for there is one reality and not two independent realities, one immobile, the other mobile. So you see, Sri Aurobindo is a pure Advaita Vedantin. He believes that there are not two. There is only one Brahman. There is only one reality. You pitch it to the consciousness as saguna. Then it has qualities. It has movement. It has dynamic. And you pitch it to the consciousness as nirguna. Then it is absent of qualities. It is absent of movement. It is static. You say it is kshara, that term we're very familiar with from the Gita, which means the perishable, or it is akshara, that which is imperishable. The perishable world, this moving, mutable world before us, and the imperishable, that static, sheer consciousness of the absolute which we can experience as Brahman or as Atman. But these are a single reality. To the integral view, it does not demarcate, does not divide them. He continues, in the ordinary view of the soul's evolution into the action, pravritti, and its involution into the passivity, nivritti, it is supposed that in the action, the individual soul becomes ignorant, nescient of its passive, which is supposed to be its true being, And in the passivity, it becomes finally nescient of its active, which is supposed to be its false or only apparent being. Well, let's pause and look at these terms. Pravritti. First, vritti, to turn, to revolve. So pravritti is a movement outward. In the Vaisheshika, the Vaisheshika philosophy, it is moving towards, moving onward, something which is progressive, seeking to possess. And nivritti is seeking to get rid of. It is a returning or a seizing from. So if you follow that, then you leave the active behind as being a false picture of your being, because truly you are this silent, passive entity inside, not externalized in endless motivity, but still. He continues now, but this is because these two movements take place alternately for us, as in our sleep and waking. We pass in waking into nescience of our sleeping condition, in sleep into nescience of our waking being. So we don't seem to be able to possess both states at once. One becomes nescient. In other words, we're not conscious of it. When we're awake, we're unconscious of the sleeping being. When we're asleep, we're unconscious of the waking being. But this happens because only part of our being performs this alternative movement, and we falsely think of ourselves as only that partial existence. But we can discover by a deeper psychological experience that the larger being in us is perfectly aware of all that happens in what is to our partial and superficial being a state of unconsciousness. It is limited neither by sleep nor by waking. So you can see these are like waves on the top of an oceanic being, both sleeping and waking, are expressions of this far greater, deeper, more profound entity, which lies unseen to both these avenues of expression and non-expression. So, so it is in our relations with Brahman, who is our real and integral being. In the ignorance, we identify ourselves with only a partial consciousness, mental or spiritual mental in its nature, which becomes nescient of itself of status by movement. In this part of us, when we lose the movement, we lose at the same time our hold on our self of action by entering into passivity. By an entire passivity, the mind falls asleep or enters into trance or else is liberated into a spiritual silence. But though it is a liberation from the ignorance of the partial being in its flux of action, it is earned by putting on a luminous nescience of the dynamic reality or a luminous separation from it. The spiritual mental being remains self-absorbed in a silent, essential status of existence and becomes either incapable of active consciousness or repugnant to all activity. This release of silence is a status through which the soul passes in its journey towards the Absolute. But there is a greater fulfillment of our true and integral being in which both the static and dynamic sides of the self are liberated and fulfilled in that which upholds both and is limited neither by action nor by silence. So it is a partial being which restricts the oneness into this relative duality. And this even has its imprint upon a great liberation of consciousness when we become aware only of that silence and can absorb ourselves in that and withdraw and leave behind the active world. It is a great liberation, but it is not a realization of the integral Brahman, which includes too the active. He continues, for Brahman does not pass alternately from passivity to activity and back to passivity by cessation of its dynamic force of being. If that were really true of the integral reality, then while the universe continued, there would be no passive Brahman in existence. All would be action. And if our universe were dissolved, there would be no active Brahman. All would become cessation and immobile stillness. But this is not so. For we can become aware of an eternal passivity and self-concentrated calm, penetrating and upholding all the cosmic activity and all its multiply concentrated movement. And this could not be if, so long as any activity continued, the concentrated passivity did not exist supporting it and within it. This is that image of Nataraj, isn't it? Go back to that chapter early on in the Life Divine, the pure existent, where he describes the one multiplied endlessly to the view. It is only one reality. But it takes up its station inside all of the multiplicity. Every single dot of its expression is filled entirely with its infinite being. Only that exists. And if you look at that gaze of Nataraj, you see not only the swirling dance, the cosmic movement proceeding from his dynamic being, but in those closed eyes and the rapturous expression on his face, the felicity, the bliss of a consciousness that has never been stirred by its movement. It continues to be entirely both things, because both the passive and the active are expressive states of its unknowable reality. So we continue. Integral Brahman possesses both the passivity and the activity simultaneously and does not pass alternately from one to the other as from a sleep to a waking. It is only some partial activity in us which seems to do that. And we, by identifying ourselves with that partial activity, have the appearance of this alternation from one nescience to another nescience. But our true, our integral being is not subject to these opposites, and it does not need to become unaware of its dynamic self in order to possess itself of silence. When we get the integral knowledge and the integral liberation of both soul and nature free from the disabilities of the restricted, partial, and ignorant being, we too can possess the passivity and the activity with a simultaneous possession, exceeding both these poles of the universality, limited by neither of these powers of the self in its relation or non-relation to nature. And without having to state it, of course, he can demonstrate that this is the key to the later transformation. The Supreme, it has been declared in the Gita, exceeds both the immobile self and the mobile being. Even put together, they do not represent all he is. For obviously, we do not mean, when we speak of his possessing them simultaneously, that he is the sum of a passivity and an activity, an integer made of those two fractions, passive with 3/4 of himself, active with 1/4 of his existence. Well, this is a profound reference to Vedic and Vedantic vision. When he speaks about the Supreme as declared in the Gita, he is referring to the 15th chapter of the Gita, the Purushottama Yoga, where the three Purushas are described. Look those verses up in chapter 15, verses 16 to 19. You get the full sense of the mobile, the mutable, the perishable self, the sense of the self which is always free, inactive, passive, aloof from the world, and yet a third reality, a greater reality, which subsumes both universe and self within its larger being. That is the Purushottama. That is the third step from which both come. Chapter 15, verses 16 to 19. And then this idea of 1/4 of the reality of the divine being expressed in the cosmos. That is a Vedic image. That is from the Rig Veda. In that case, he continues, Brahman might be a sum of nesciences, the passive 3/4, not only indifferent to, but quite ignorant of all that the activity is doing, the active 1/4, quite unaware of the passivity and unable to possess it except by ceasing from action. Even Brahman, the sum, might amount to something quite different from his two fractions, something, as it were, up and aloof, ignorant of and irresponsible for anything which some mystic Maya was at once obstinately doing and rigidly abstaining from doing in the two fractions of his existence. But it is clear that Brahman, the Supreme Being, must be aware both of the passivity and the activity, and regard them not as his absolute being, but as opposite yet mutually satisfying terms of his universalities. This would seem to say that both passivity and activity obtain within the universal expression of Brahman, but not necessarily exhaustive of the innate nature of Brahman. It cannot be true that Brahman, by an eternal passivity, is unaware, entirely separated from his own activities. Free, he contains them in himself, supports them with his eternal power of calm, initiates them from his eternal poise of energy. It must be equally untrue that Brahman, in his activity, is unaware of or separated from his passivity. Omnipresent, he is there supporting the action, possesses it always in the heart of the movement, and is eternally calm and still and free and blissful in all the whirl of its energies. Not in either silence or action can he be at all unaware of his absolute being, but knows that all he expresses through them draws its value and power from the power of that absolute existence. If it seems otherwise to our experience, it is because we identify with one aspect, and by that exclusiveness fail to open ourselves to the integral reality. There necessarily follows an important first result, already arrived at from other viewpoints, that the ignorance cannot have the origin of its existence or the starting point of its dividing activities in the absolute Brahman or in integral Satchit Ananda, It belongs only to a partial action of the being with which we identify ourselves. Just as in the body, we identify ourselves with that partial and superficial consciousness which alternates between sleep and waking. It is indeed this identification, putting aside all the rest of the reality behind us, that is the constituting cause of the ignorance. In other words, ignorance does not arise in the absolute or in Satchit-Ananda itself. Satchit-Ananda being a positive expression of the absolute. The ignorance must be only a partial action of it. And he says, and if ignorance is not an element or power proper to the absolute nature of the Brahman or to its integrality, there can be no original and primal ignorance. Maya, if it be an original power of the consciousness of the eternal, cannot itself be an ignorance or in any way akin to the nature of ignorance, but must be a transcendent and universal power of self-knowledge and all knowledge. Ignorance can only intervene as a minor and subsequent movement, partial and relative. So ignorance does not have an ontological status where it is in competition with other aspects of the divine reality or being. It is derivative. So, if it is derivative, it must have a positive purpose because all does as it flows out of the conscious will of the Supreme. But we have been examining the oneness of the being of Brahman, that there is only one Brahman. Now we have to turn our attention to another question. Is it then, he's speaking here again about ignorance, is it then something inherent in the multiplicity of souls? Does it, ignorance, come into being immediately Brahman views himself in the multiplicity? And does that multiplicity consist of a sum of souls, each in its very nature fractional, and divided from all the others in consciousness, unable to become aware of them at all, except as things external to it, linked at most by communication from body to body or mind to mind, but incapable of unity? But we have seen that this is only what we seem to be in our most superficial layer of consciousness, the external mind and the physical. When we get back into a subtler, deeper, larger action of our consciousness, we find the walls of division becoming thinner, and in the end, there is left no wall of division, no ignorance. So in other words, no. Multiplicity will not be convicted of the creation of ignorance. He continues, though, we have to look at the source of division. Body is the outward sign and lowest basis of the apparent division, which nature, plunging into ignorance and self-nescience, makes the starting point for the recovery of unity by the individual soul. Unity, even in the midst of the most exaggerated forms of her multiple consciousness. Again, a signature of a deep intent. This apparent division is meant to be a ladder leading back to a profounder unity. The loss is wholly reversed and treasure regained, that treasure of the oneness of the integral divine. Bodies cannot communicate with each other except by external means and through a gulf of externality, cannot penetrate each other except by division of the penetrated body or by taking advantage of some gap in it, some pre-existent division, cannot unite except by a breaking up and devouring, a swallowing and absorption, and so an assimilation, or at most a fusion in which both forms disappear. Mind, too, when identified with body, is hampered by its limitations, but in itself it is more subtle, and two minds can penetrate each other without hurt or division, can interchange their substance without mutual injury, can, in a way, become parts of each other. Still, mind too has its own form, which is separative of it from other minds, and is apt to take its stand on this separateness. When we get back to soul consciousness, the obstacles to unity lessen and finally cease to exist altogether. The soul can, in its consciousness, identify itself with other souls, can contain them and enter into and be contained by them, can realize its unity with them. And this can take place not in a featureless and indistinguishable sleep, not in a nirvana in which all distinctions and individualities of soul and mind and body are lost, but in a perfect waking which observes and takes account of all distinctions, but exceeds them. Therefore, ignorance and self-limiting division are not inherent and insuperable in the multiplicity of souls, are not the very nature of the multiplicity of Brahman. Brahman, as he exceeds the passivity and the activity, so too exceeds the unity and multiplicity. He is one in himself, but not with a self-limiting unity exclusive of the power of multiplicity, such as is the separated unity of the body and the mind. He is not the mathematical integer, one, which is incapable of containing the hundred, and is therefore less than the hundred. He contains the hundred, is one in all the hundred, one in himself. He is one in the many, and the many are one in him. In other words, Brahman, in his unity of spirit, is aware of his multiplicity of souls, and in the consciousness of his multiple souls, is aware of the unity of all souls. In each soul, he, the immanent spirit, the Lord in each heart, is aware of his oneness. The Jivatman, illumined by him, aware of its unity with the one, is also aware of its unity with the many. Our superficial consciousness, identified with body and with divided life and dividing mind, is ignorant. But that also can be illumined and made aware. Multiplicity, then, is not the necessary cause of the ignorance. So, the multiple, one with the integral Brahman, are not causative of this separative power of ignorance. We have to look for the cosmic origin of that elsewhere. Not in being seen as a oneness, seen in its singularity, or seen in its distributed manyness. What is it then? Ignorance, as we have already stated, comes in at a later stage, as a later movement, when mind is separated from its spiritual and supramental basis, and culminates in this earth life, where the individual consciousness in the many identifies itself by dividing mind with the form, which is the only safe basis of division. So ignorance arises cosmically through the separational mind. He is referred to this absolute, which in a sense posits itself as Satchit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, which in constellating its own expressive power as a supramental agency takes the oneness of the divine and multiplies it. And each multiplied self, each aspect, is a unique reality which is always one with that supreme, never loses its identity with that. And that is what he calls the Jivatman. The Atman is single, is one. But the Jivatman expresses that singleness multiply. And each one of those multiple numbers is that same oneness. But as this supramental reality leans into its distribution, and that distribution disengages itself from the massive harmonic unity which is the supramental vision in reality, it enters into this separative motion where the mind becomes the parent of ignorance. But what is the form? It is, at least as we see it here, a formation of concentrated energy, a knot of the force of consciousness in its movement, a knot maintained in being by a constant whirl of action. But whatever transcendent truth or reality it proceeds from or expresses, it is not in any part of itself in manifestation, durable or eternal. It is not eternal in its integrality, nor in its constituting atoms, for they can be disintegrated by dissolving the knot of energy in constant concentrated action, which is the sole thing that maintains their apparent stability. It is a concentration of tapas in movement of force on the form maintaining it in being, which sets up the physical basis of division. But all things in the activity are, we have seen, a concentration of tapas in movement of force upon its object. The origin of the ignorance must then be sought for in some self-absorbed concentration of tapas, of conscious force in action on a separate movement of the force. To us, this takes the appearance of mind identifying itself with the separate movement and identifying itself also in the movement separately with each of the forms resulting from it. So, it builds a wall of separation which shuts out the consciousness in each form from awareness of its own total self, of other embodied consciousnesses, and of universal being. It is here that we must look for the secret of the apparent ignorance of the embodied mental being, as well as of the great apparent inconscience of physical nature. We have to ask ourselves, what is the nature of this absorbing, this separating, this self-forgetful concentration, which is the obscure miracle of the universe? So there is this movement of conscious being to identify in concentrated way with form and to disidentify itself from other selves, which is the the movement of consciousness which allows ignorance to manifest. So this we are looking for, an origin not only of ignorance as it occurs in the individual, but the root of cosmic ignorance. It is in this concentration of power. Just as when we absorb ourselves in an exclusive object, could be the reading of a newspaper, the writing of a letter, and all else becomes absent to us. By identifying solely with that act, we have excluded all other things. Is this the root, in a larger way, a cosmic way? Does this analogically explain how ignorance arrives and why we deal with division? We take up next, in the 13th chapter, exclusive concentration of consciousness force and the ignorance. We are now more than halfway into the life divine. Congratulations. That concludes this chapter. Next week, we start the 13th. Now we continue with our reading in Savitri. From where we left off last week, we're in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 6, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. These are her deeds in this huge world ignorance. Till the veil is lifted, till the night is dead, in light or dark, she keeps her tireless search. Time is her road of endless pilgrimage, one mighty passion motives all her works. Her eternal lover is her action's cause. For him she leaped forth from the unseen vasts, to move here in a stark, unconscious world. Its acts are her commerce with her hidden guest, his moods she takes for her heart's passionate molds. In beauty she treasures the sunlight of his smile. Ashamed of her rich cosmic poverty, she cajoles with her small gifts his mightiness, holds with her scenes his look's fidelity, and woos his large-eyed wandering thoughts to dwell in figures of her million-impulsed force. Only to attract her veiled companion and keep him close to her breast in her world cloak, lest from her arms he turn to his formless peace, is her heart's business and her clinging care. Yet when he is most near, she feels him far. For contradiction is her nature's law. Although she is ever in him, and he in her, as if unaware of the eternal tie, her will is to shut God into her works, and keep him as her cherished prisoner, that never they may part again in time. A sumptuous chamber of the spirit's sleep, at first she made a deep interior room where he slumbers as if a forgotten guest. But now she turns to break the oblivious spell, awakes the sleeper on the sculptured couch. She finds again the presence in the form, and in the light that wakes with him recovers a meaning in the hurry and trudge of time. And through this mind that once obscured the soul passes a glint of unseen deity. Across a luminous dream of spirit space, she builds creation like a rainbow bridge between the original silence and the void. A net is made of the mobile universe. She weaves a snare for the conscious infinite. So, thank you. Namaste. Jai Ma.